Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Spark London. We tell true stories, we tell them live, and we tell them all across London. And my name's Dave, and I host the Hackney branch of Spark. And today's episode is going to be a very different episode. The person who makes our podcast generally, Matt Hill, is currently very busy. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to sort of commandeer the podcast for 1 week and make something that kind of represents the feel of an open mic. I host an open mic at the Hackney Attic on the second Monday of every month. Today's episode is a collection of stories that were told at one of those nights. The theme was open heart. A few of them have already been out on our podcast, so regular listeners will have heard a couple of them before. There's been a few stories that I had to leave out for time, but I think the selection that I'm giving you gives you a real sense of the variety that you can get at a Spark London open mic. In between the stories, I've put some songs from various music projects that I've been involved in over the years. So that kind of gives us some contemplation time, hopefully, between stories. So the first storyteller you'll hear is me. I generally tell the first story at the Spark Hackney open mic, because I like to demonstrate that, hey, anyone can do it. Next, you'll hear Grenier. And after that, you'll hear my dad, Peter. He's telling a kind of different version of the same story that I told to begin with. So you hear different perspectives on that story. Next up, you have Sahand, who was a storyteller visiting from Amsterdam, and his story is amazing. Then next you have Spark regular Patricia. After that you've got Daniel, Miranda, Ethne and Rob. I hope you enjoy what we're doing today. It's something a little bit different. It's much longer. So get yourself a cup of tea or lean back and close your eyes on the train and let this take you away from the commute or send you to sleep, because at Spark London, what we're really about is connecting people through stories. And so we're really happy to be able to connect you to these stories now.
So when I was 6 years old, I was sharing a bed with my father. We were in Cornwall. It was a family holiday. And I woke up in the morning and he wasn't there beside me. And I didn't know where he was. And I was really, really scared about where he might be. I've realised since then that if everything had turned out all right, I would have forgotten this moment. This would have just been a forgotten moment. But because I was right and something was wrong, it has become very significant in my life. So I got out of bed and I went into the next room, and my dad was in our family friend's bed, sitting up, looking wrong, you know, not looking his normal self. And it was explained to me that he'd had a heart attack. And that was how I found out. Now, when I was born, my dad was 58 years old. He was an older father. But when I was six, I suddenly realized what that actually meant. And he was okay. It was a minor heart attack, whatever that means. And scoot forward to when I'm 15. And I'm told that my dad is going into hospital to have a triple heart bypass. And This was an intense piece of information to hear as a 15-year-old boy who had pretty much forgotten about the first heart attack, forgotten that his life might be in danger. And so my sister came down for this event, and we went to the hospital and we said goodbye to my dad in the hospital, who was sort of they were prepping him, I guess, or getting ready to prep him. And we got into the bus, and my sister took out this hip flask and had a swig. And then she said to me, "Do you want some?" And this was another moment where things changed for me, because I was like, hang on, now I'm old enough that people are like offering me alcohol. This is pretty cool. So we went home, and the next morning I woke up and my dad was having a heart bypass, and I didn't know what to do with myself. I couldn't think. I didn't really know what was going on, really. And the doorbell rang and I went downstairs to open it. And there at the front door was a really tall, like 6 foot guy, big fat guy with like cock eyes, and a short, very deep voiced guy. These were my friends. They weren't just random people. This is my friend Owen and my friend Steve. And I didn't know that they knew that my dad was having a heart bypass. And I didn't know that they were the kind of friends that would do this for me. And again, in that moment, something changed. I realized these were good friends, not just friends that you have a laugh with, but friends that gave a fuck about you, you know? And they took me out to the art gallery. It's in Cardiff, where I lived at the time. They took me to the art gallery there, which was just a load of like old guys in wigs. So we're sort of walking around this art gallery, looking at these old guys in wigs, and like Steve and Owen, they're not the kind of guys that go to art galleries. Like these days, Steve's a builder. And like, I'm not saying builders don't go to art galleries, but he doesn't. And they're from a very working class part of Cardiff called Ely. And, it was strange to me that they'd taken me to this art gallery that wasn't on their radar. It wasn't even on my radar. I didn't go to art galleries at that time. And if I go to art galleries, I'm not going to look at old men in wigs. But somehow, everything just felt right, that I was there with my friends and I didn't have to think about my dad in the hospital too much. And I knew that I was loved by them, and I knew that things were going to be okay somehow. And then I left them and I went to Pizza Express to meet my sister, who was taking me out for lunch. And again, we got really, really drunk and talked about our different... I talked about my girlfriend. She talked about her boyfriend. Like, there's like 20 years between us, yeah? So this was a kind of intense kind of moment where I'm like, I'm being an adult, and nobody's noticing. And my dad was okay. And that day, though, when he went in to have his heart kind of operated on, his chest opened up. And actually, when they got in there, they did a quadruple bypass just for fun, you know. That day when my dad's chest was opened, my heart was kind of opened too, because I suddenly learned that my friends were a different kind of people. We were closer in different kinds of ways than I'd ever known. And that my sister and me had a kind of bond as equals, rather than as a child and an adult. Thanks very much.
I am hearing cars in rain. I am sucking my arms again. There's nothing to read and nothing to eat. There's no way that I am going to sleep. I am hearing that drunk again, singing that old song the same. A human way old song. Tonight I along. It goes.
Wanted to talk to you about this. The theme is open heart. So when I think about that, I think of trying. I am the queen of trying. Maybe I should reveal I'm sort of a former school project superstar. Growing up in primary school, I was the competition. There was no, if I was entering, whether it was a baking competition, a project competition, if I was entering it, you probably wouldn't even bother. That was me. I was the superstar. I even won a PE award. even that sort of surprised me. I don't know how I got away with that. But I took it really seriously because I really wanted to put myself out there. I really wanted to try. And that's scary, putting yourself out there. It's really hard. And as you get older, it sometimes gets harder because it's easier to put yourself out there when you've nothing to lose. But then as you get older, things become more complicated. And I remember the key thing probably when I was a teenager, and there's this boy I was madly in love with called Declan O'Donoghue, and I was absolutely crazy about him. It was easy to understand why a 15-year-old girl would love him, because he had seen Titanic 7 times. And he could do long division in his head. He was pretty much the dreamboat, the dream guy. And I loved him so much, I became almost associated with him because I went to an all-girls school. So I became known as the girl who was in love with Declan O'Donoghue. That was just who I was. But of course, I wasn't like some hussy. Like, I would never like ask him out or ring him up. No, I just would stalk him. And this was even before Facebook made that socially acceptable. But I was in love with him. I was crazy about him, in the way that a 15-year-old girl can be. And then one day, my telephone rang in my house, remember those days, and I answered it, and it was this person claiming to be Declan O'Donoghue. And honest, this shows you what my brain was like. My first instinct was, this is one of my friends playing a prank. So he said, would you like to go to the cinema on Saturday? And I went, this isn't Declan O'Donoghue, and I hung up. Of course, I found out about a month later that it was Declan O'Donoghue. And all these time later, even now when I think about it, I just think, oh. Because I just think of the life that we could have had together. You know, we had so much in common. We both love Titanic. I'm terrible at sums, but that would be the thing we had different from each other. He could do sums in his head. I can't do sums. So that would be the frisson between us. But then I think maybe that, because it's scary, that was hard to do, even taking the risk that it was him, that it wasn't one of my friends playing a prank. And there were so many things later on that I was able to do that seemed much scarier. Like I went on a clown course in Italy by accident. Like, literally by accident. I saw this sign, I was doing these drama classes, and I saw a sign saying, comedy acting in Italy. And I thought, oh, that must be like learning to be like Charlie Chaplin in Italy for a month. For 3 months. Why wouldn't that be fun? I flew all the way over to Italy, arrived there, discovered it wasn't comedy acting, it was commedia dell'arte, which I don't know if any of you know is very different. I thought it would be 3 months of just like skipping and clicking my heels. Instead, it was 3 months of what is essentially like Benny Hill, but in Italian. Like, not funny in the slightest, but it was too late. I was there and we had to do like tango dancing, which as like an Irish country girl, it was not exactly my forte. It was hideous. It was one of the most painful things ever. And then we had to do sort of like sketches. And rather than risk like actually doing this new form of comedy acting that I didn't really know, I didn't understand because it was in Italian, I just, because I realised nobody else in the course really knew anything about Irish or British comedy. So I just used to do like fast show sketches or what other ones? I did a lot of Blackadder sketches, a lot of Father Ted. They hadn't seen any of these TV programs. So this whole class of Spanish and Italian and some American students all thought I was some sort of comedy genius. scared. I was scared. I didn't want to embarrass myself. And then off the back of that, I was like, oh, I've lived in Italy. What will I do next? I thought, well, I want to move to a hot country again, because I thought this is my only thinking. I just thought, well, I want to live somewhere where fruit is cheap and maybe I drink more water. So I thought I'll move to Madrid. That was my only reasoning. And again, that kind of sounds like that's scary, but it's not scary. It's just feckless more than anything else. And I kind of didn't really know what I was doing, because I'd gone from this like former, you know, primary school superstar to just like working in an Irish pub. So I wasn't really sure what I was doing. I was trying to be all like bohemian and cool, which actually involved just sleeping on a lot of park benches. No, I wasn't homeless. I just thought, oh my God, I'm like Henry Miller. Don't do that. People just steal your bags. And I just thought of all the things that I regretted, because I thought, oh, I'm living this life. Like, oh, I've no regrets, like seizing the day. But I did have regrets. Why didn't I just say, yes, Declan O'Donoghue, I will go to the cinema with you? Because when I was in Spain, I was staying in this monastery. And they discovered this mass grave from the Franco period. And this was a mass grave of communists who had been shot by Franco soldiers. And even today, how it's run so deep, even the archaeologists who were digging the bodies up, they were being shunned by the townspeople because they were like, that's the past. But we were helping the archaeologists, and one day we got up really early and we helped them with the dig. And it's incredible. We were digging up the bodies, like we were digging up this past of all these people on the wrong side of history who tried and failed. They'd failed. And one day when we were there, a granddaughter of one of the people buried there brought her child along just to witness what had happened. And I just felt so proud to be part of that, because even if you do fail, you do put your heart out there and it all goes completely wrong. I mean, there's something, that's what history is, you know, that's maybe what makes us all human. So that's it, that's the end.
I know your light is on somewhere. I think of it. Suddenly I'm there. You are the rain, and I am the street. And the light, I can't describe it. I bought you chocolate in the rain. Soaked myself to the bottom of my bed. Oh, I am sweet, you are beautiful. This room and you, it's all I wanna know. This room and you, it's all I want to know.
Well, some of this story may be familiar to you, but it's about hearts, so I had to think of a story about hearts. And I must say, my heart was perfectly all right until I was in my mid-60s, except for the fact that as an open heart, it was probably broken every month from the time I was 9 until the time I was 70. In fact, it was even broken earlier than that. There was a young blonde-haired girl in the infants that I still remember. It's about hearts, isn't it? And when I was in my mid-60s, things did happen to it. I was taking my two sons, who were then about 6 and 10, and my granddaughter, who was about 7, down to see my ex-wife in her cottage in Cornwall. And I was taking him on the train, and we were sitting in the restaurant car, which you could do. There was a sort of car next door to the restaurant car, which our American friends would probably call a club car, where you could drink. And in those days, you could actually smoke. So I was smoking and drinking, and the children were consuming whatever they'd wanted, which I thought would keep them quiet. And I got a slight pain, but I didn't think very much of that and forgot about it. Anyway, we got there that night, and the children went to bed, and my ex-wife went to bed, and a friend of an old friend of ours, who a woman who I'd known a long time ago, and who was actually a nurse, a district nurse, came down to stay, and we sat up that night together, drinking whiskey and smoking, or at least I was smoking, I don't know whether she was, and we were talking about old days and times and things, and I said to her in the middle of it, I said, by the way, Sue, I got this odd sort of pain yesterday, but I don't suppose I should do anything about it. She said, well, where was it? And I said, well, I don't know, somewhere down here, in the chest sort of area. And she said, well, I think you should see a doctor. But I said, well, I don't really want to do that. I mean, that's a bit extreme. And I went to bed. My recollection is that I actually went to bed downstairs. This pain became talking, very, very acute, and I immediately felt, Sue, medical, and went and told her. And from then on, it's all, like you may have heard, it became a heart attack. So there I was, in a Cornish hospital, having a heart attack, which I recovered from. And, you know, apart from my heart being broken every month or so continually after that, nothing really happened again until I, some 10, 12 years later, I had a sharp pain, which I knew then, by then, was in fact something to do with my heart. And there's a word for it which I can't remember. I can't remember many words. But anyway, the doctor said, you've got angina. Thank you. Yes, you've got angina. You better do something about that. You better go straight into hospital. So I went into hospital, and I was there, and they did a few tests on me. And then the James Robertson Justice sort of character came round, who was the consultant with his team of white, his followers, his white-coated followers, students and other doctors. And they all stood at my bed, and he said, this man's condition is life-threatening. We've got to get him into surgery pretty quickly. It was, I think, on a Thursday, and he said, we'll send him down on Friday. So I was, I said, can I go home? And he said, no, you stay here and get stuff sent in. You get your family to send stuff in, which they did. And there were two very nice young nurses who looked after me. And I went in to have this. I asked him, I said, what does it mean, a quadruple bypass? He said, oh, well, we just cut down your breastbone and open your chest and take your heart out virtually and mess about with it and put it back in and, you know. So I said, oh, well, that sounds good. And I thought, yeah, well, I should be terrified. And then I suddenly remembered that I'd had, like, I know people think of sort of people who are at war, the Second World War, etc., because of sort of films and stories, the only ones that are told are the interesting ones. One has the impression that everybody who was in the Second World War was sort of fighting the Germans. In actual fact, like most armies in most situations, well, certainly since technology has arisen, has sort of made it necessary, for every sort of person who's actually in the infantry or in the tanks and actually facing immediate sort of possible death, there are vast resources of people in the Ordnance Corps and the REMI and various things like this. And I was one of those, one of the 80% who were probably didn't see very much in the army. I was in a heavy ACAC regiment, which followed the British Army through Africa and Italy during a time when air supremacy had been certain. We had complete air supremacy, so there was really no need for ACAC guns at all. There was no air defence needed. But, you know, you met You met women, Italian women and African women. You drank in foreign bars. You did your whatever job you had to do, like laying the telephone lines or that sort of thing. But generally speaking, your life was pretty easy. And so when I suddenly faced this quadruple bypass and this cleaving of my chest and all that, I thought, my God, this is my chance to be sort of a hero, you know? Somebody, I'm sort of facing death, you know? And in fact, I enjoyed it. And the whole experience became for me a great sort of, you know, spiritual uplift. I thought, at last, I'm sort of level with all those comrades of mine who, because I had a great friend who'd been in England, and on D-Day he'd gone over, and within 2 days he'd been blown out of two tanks, and he came back, and that was the end of his war. He was rather messed up by it. So anyway, I saw this as a great challenge, and I went through it, and I got out quicker than anybody ever had through the special care unit, and here I still am, amazingly. And that is my my version.
Breathing this air is like waiting for a passport to be processed. Dressed, I'll be a disappointment. I won't look my best. We have to leave. We have to go. Where we're going, I don't know. We write our names in the condensation on the glass at the bus station. Don't look at the city, do not turn your head, just think about all those things we said. We have to leave, we have to go. Where we're going, I don't know. Let's go.
Okay, 7 years ago I was huge in Amsterdam in the spotting scene with my Balkan gypsy band. Then we bought a van and we traveled to Eastern Europe, and we're playing in different cities in Hungary, in Romania, in Croatia. We go to the north of Hungary, to Transylvania, and we have this, excuse my French, piece of shit, crappy van that breaks down every 500 kilometers. But our bass player, he's an engineer, he can fix everything. And we play and we drink, but our violinist is also a general practitioner, so she can fix everything. All of us, and things are going swell. I'm always the very first person to wake up because I'm the only one in the band who doesn't have a driver's license. So whenever people are driving, I can sleep, and then we basically drive until it's too dark and people are too exhausted. We build up our tents, and then I wake up usually to an amazing landscape. Now, we went to a place called Brislop, which supposedly had this amazing folk music festival, and we thought if we're there, we're going to have a great time, and I'm the first one who's awake. I walk into the village, and what I see is basically this medieval village, and there is no musicians. There is no dancers. There is no nothing. There is a guy and a cow and another guy walking along with a cart, and I'm this sort of, like, scruffy-looking Middle Easterner. They have no idea. They're looking at me, huh? And I don't give up. I walk in the village. And at some point, I meet a guy standing in his doorway, and he's got a big red nose, and he says, And so we've been traveling in Eastern Europe long enough to realize that that is international for come on in, have a drink. It's 8 a.m, but, you know, he was being very friendly. So in some kind of international language, I try to explain to him, we're looking for a music festival, and he basically points with his hands, look, it's a village, 150 people live here, there is no festival. So I go back to the band. And by this time, these guys are waking up, and I say to them, there is nothing happening in this village. And they say, okay, well, let's grab our instruments, let's go into the village, let's play a few songs for the locals, and then we'll just drive on. Now, before, people were surprised at one scruffy guy walking in their village. This is a village where nothing happens. Now there are 7 of us. You know, some people with dreadlocks, with strange instruments. And one guy, he's 18 years old, he panics. He looks at us, and he says, don't move, don't move. And he runs off, and we don't know what to do. Sure enough, he comes back in 10 minutes, and he's got the village priest. And the village priest, now, he's a guy, he's about 1 meter 90. He's all dressed in black, and he's got a big red beard. His name is Father Irenaeus. And Father Irenaeus of this medieval village, he says, what are you guys doing here? We say, we're a band, we're quite popular in the squatting scene in Amsterdam. We want to play some music for you. And he says, well, let me first show you our church. Now, they've got a tiny church. It's a beautiful church. And we go in, and suddenly this medieval priest, he takes out a laser pointer and starts to point out various icons on the walls. And it's all kind of cool, but he says some weird things like, you know, you see these images, they're kind of similar to Buddhism symbolism. You know, here you've got something that sort of reflects Sufi mythology. And okay, I don't expect to hear that in a medieval village in northern Romania. But fair enough, we explain our predicament and he says, okay, after Mass today, why don't you come to the big barn? It's owned by my parents, and then you guys can give a concert there. I'll invite the rest of the village. And that's what we do. We kind of hang around. There's not much to do. We wait. The whole village, all 150, go into the church. And when the church service is over, you see all of them sort of file out. You know, there's the wee little ones. There is the grandparents and grandmothers. There's the strong farmers. And they all kind of go to the big barn of the village, the barn that's owned by the parents of the priest. And that's where we set up and we start to play. And no one's dancing. And everyone's staring. Now, we play Eastern European music. We play their music for them. And they're kind of looking at us like we're freaks. In the second song, the old lady, the mother of the priest, she gets up. She gets up off her headscarf and starts to dance. Not long after that, people are kind of looking at the priest, and the priest says, oh, go on. And then they start to dance. And it doesn't take long, and it's a great party, and we're having a great time. We play for half an hour, for an hour and a half. Finally, you know, the priest said, you must be tired, now it's our turn. And he sort of snaps his fingers. Some little boys walk in with a laptop. They hook it up to some cables. There is all these boxes in the barn, music comes out, it turns into a disco, it's amazing, it's a folk music disco. But we want to know, what's going on here? What's happening? Why were they so hesitant when we came to play for them? Even in a previous village, something similar had happened. There was a wedding, there was no band. We said, we'll play for you for free. They looked at us, they said, we're good Christians, we don't want music. This is weird. I come from a Muslim country, there I can understand, but here, you know, Eastern Europe, they love music. So the priest says, well, you know, you come at an odd time. We've got certain days and weeks in the year where we're not allowed to listen to music. It's our fasting period. So then I said, hold on, Mr. Priest. You mean to say that during the fasting period, you, the priest of the town, invited a heathen band from Amsterdam to play in your village? And you let people dance? And the priest said, yeah, that's what the other people told me as well. But then I said to them, if God decided to send us a band in this period, who are we to say no? We had an amazing time with Father Irenaeus, and even better than the adventure we had the night before was the breakfast we had in the morning and the story that he told us of how he, the son of a miller, became a priest. He wasn't even supposed to be a priest, but since this is only the 5-minute storytelling night, that's a story I'll tell you guys next time if you invite me. Thank you. Let's go.
A lot of the I'm actually, well, obviously I'm not from this country, but I also am not from the country I sound like I'm from. I'm from Transylvania, actually, which isn't a country. It used to be. It's now Romania. And so my parents and I immigrated to the States when I was about six. And my dad's a doctor, but what happens when you move to the States is, and I'm not really sure about the bureaucracy of this, but your degree has an equivalent in the States. So my father was a practicing, I almost said attorney, doctor in Romania. And when we moved to the States, the government or whoever does this recognized his MD only, not his residency, not his specialization, not his anything. So he had to do all of that over again. So money was very tight for a long time, until I was 14. Money was tight. And my dad for a while had a autopsy business on the side. And I wanted to be a doctor until I was 18. And so this sort of nexus happened where he had an autopsy business when I still wanted to be a doctor, when I was about 13 and 14. And he said, one day he said, well, I'm going to dissect some organs today. Do you want to come with me? It'll be cool. And I said, sure. And I was actually really excited about that. It was more like, sure, yes. And my mother looked at us like we were insane. And I went with him, and we dissected a lot of things. Brains are cool because a brain is like a bread. If you take it out and you wash it, there wasn't any blood. But we dissected a lot of hearts. And so when you dissect a brain, it's just you open it up, and it's just sort of like marble cake. But a heart has chambers, and so I actually learned all of the chambers by cutting open a heart with my dad, and that was really awesome. And you learn a lot of things. For example, if you have a heart attack, which several people in the audience have had, apparently, it shows up as a dark spot in the heart muscle. And if it's a small dark spot, it's a small heart attack. And if it's a big dark spot, that's probably why the person died. And we found, well, my dad was cutting and he hit something hard and made a face that was like, hmm. And it was a plastic heart valve that they'd had installed, and he hadn't known about that from the patient history. Anyway, so I had all of these great bonding experiences with my dad cutting open human organs, and he did all of this with a very sharp knife. And every time we would go, my mother would say, you know, be careful, don't cut yourself. And he would wear gloves, but every once in a while, you know, he'd nick himself with the knife and it would obviously cut open the glove and he'd bleed a little. And I was totally fine with that, because it wasn't life-threatening. And then slowly over time, my relationship to knives changed dramatically, because while my mother looked at my dad and I like we were crazy, it turned out she was the crazy one. And she would have all of these bizarre narcissistic breakdowns where she decided we didn't love her because, I don't know, we didn't want to go to the restaurant she wanted us to go to. And so she would express that a lot with knives, that she would sometimes hold up to herself or hold up to my father. And so I started to be really stressed out about knives. And throughout this entire experience, I had the anchor that I knew my father was reasonable. And he was a sane human being. And then an odd thing happened. I decided I didn't want to be a doctor my first year of college. And I told my parents that, and they flipped a shit. Because they had moved to the United States for me, for my future. And they thought my future was in medicine because I could make a lot of money. You know, the standard reasons, not depend on somebody else. Hopefully also marry a doctor. That'd be great. And then all of a sudden that was crumbling underneath them, and my dad was upset, but my mother went ballistic. And a lot of things happened between me telling them and my mother running after me with a knife, but it sort of doesn't matter. All of a sudden I just locked myself in the bathroom, which is a scenario I'd planned out far in advance, because I kind of, like, things had happened in my family, but they hadn't involved me and knives. But I thought, you know, should this happen, that's the only room in the house that locks, and it has two doors. And I locked myself in there, sort of thinking, okay, I'm just going to sit here until things calm down. And then my mother was, like, running at one of the doors trying to break it down. And then she said to my dad for him to get his tools to take the hinges off. I thought, I should take action now. And then I thought, where is my dad? And my dad was standing behind the other door. And then he started talking and he said, Patricia, come out. I said, I'm not coming out. No. And he said, Patricia, come out. And this sort of went back and forth a few times until it became really sinister. Patricia, come out. I'm not coming out. Patricia, come out. I'm not coming out. And then finally I felt, you know, like I had to say something. I said, I'm not coming out. She's going to kill me. And there was a pause. And he said, so? Like, what do you mean, so? She's going to kill me. And he said, you should come out and see what you've done. And then I jumped out the window and ran away. And I'm not really sure where this story is going, except to say that I guess, like, when I think about the time when I started dissecting human organs with my dad, that was a really happy time in my life because I had a really great relationship with both my parents, and then I had a really great relationship with one of my parents. And then my heart is close to both of them now. And it's pretty much open to everyone else, but of course they think I'm a shriveled up shell of a human because I'm so closed up with them. And again, I don't know where the story is going, except don't run after your children with knives, please. I'm done.
I can't answer those kind of questions. I don't live in any town. I don't live in any town.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Going from open-hearted to broken-hearted and back again. And it starts 12 years ago, in the middle of India, in fact, in northern India, at the biggest ever gathering of people in history, called the Kumbh Mela, on the banks of the River Ganges, where tens of millions of pilgrims came to mix with gods and some interesting naked dreadlocked men who smoked dope all day as their religion. And I gravitated towards these friendly gentlemen and sat round the fire for several days on end, getting stoned from dawn till dusk. And it felt fantastic. And I communed with the consciousness expanding experiment of the Kumbhamela on the banks of the Ganges. And I felt at one with everybody around me, despite the fact that I was in a medieval swamp with people defecating in open sewers where they were also cooking their food. And somehow I got out of my head and my sense that I was superior or different to anybody else and became in some way part of this sea of humanity around me. And it felt so good. It felt wonderful. I went swimming in this river and everything washed away. And I thought, this is just too good to leave here. I must take this home with me somehow. And I had this idea that I could crystallize this experience in the tip of my little finger, and I could go to somewhere else in the world, and I could touch it down on the map, and I could share this love and understanding with other human beings. And at this time, I was working as a foreign correspondent, and I lived in Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, which was once the biggest republic in Yugoslavia. And this was 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, in fact, and it wasn't a part of the world that was very happy. For the 10 years before that, Yugoslavia had been falling apart in a series of vicious, brutal wars, and that was why a lot of people had, like me, gone there to write about it. By this time, though, they'd all gone, and there was nothing that the outside world really wanted to know anymore about this unhappy part of the world, where the brotherhood and unity of socialist Yugoslavia had given away to bitterness, hatred and recrimination. And where I was living in Serbia, I was in the heart of darkness of the whole story, because Serbs were deemed to have been the bad guys of the breakup of Yugoslavia, and they were the bogeymen. And their country was stagnant and stuck in a rut, and it was nominally supposed to have changed and become democratic and hopeful and different. And instead it was run by the mafia, who pretended to be Democrats and got themselves elected and given lots of money by Western taxpayers to call themselves the new business elite. And nobody really wanted to know about this, so I didn't have any stories to write. And I thought, hang on a minute, why don't I organise a music festival here in Belgrade on this island in the middle of the Danube, which also meets the River Sava, this confluence of two rivers just like the Kumbhamela. And best of all, there's this island right in the middle of the river there, called Big War Island. What better place to start a summer of love? So I carried on smoking more dope, and I thought, I'm going to go for it. Let's raise money. We can have this this peace, love and understanding festival here. The neighbouring republics will start to like Serbs again, because they've got the best music festival in southeastern Europe. The young people of Western Europe will start coming here on holiday because it's cheap and it's sunny and we've got a beach in the middle of a city, and it'll be fantastic. And all I got to do is raise money and put this thing together. The problem was, of course, that Serbs were the bad guys and nobody outside the country wanted to know. So I turned my mind to my unique competitive advantage here. I was a journalist and I had some contacts, and I was rather tired of doing my job, because my job at that time was working for the New York Times, and this was late 2002, early 2003. And the New York Times didn't really want to hear about what happened in Serbia then, except for me to write about whether or not Serbs had realized that they were villains because they hadn't stopped their government starting wars. The New York Times was at this stage printing a lot of bogus intelligence information to facilitate the invasion of Iraq, and my editor was not really au fait with the parallel that I kept trying to point out to him. So I thought, fuck my job, much better to get high all day long and run a music festival. But first I'll ask all of my former contacts to sponsor it in the name of peace, love and understanding. I tried NATO, I tried the European Union, I tried a Nobel Prize winning Auschwitz survivor. Surprisingly enough, they all said no. So I was reduced to asking the rich men of Serbia to help me out. And these nice gentlemen who, as I explained earlier, were the mafia, kindly agreed to lend us some money, which enabled us to book some bands. And we put together a four-day event on Big War Island called the Echo Festival. And it took place in the summer of 2003. 150,000 people came. It was a nice thing, until it finished. For two or three reasons, really. The first one was that I'd hoped to recreate some sort of Woodstock-like event that would bring people from all over Europe flocking to the Balkans. But like Woodstock, it had petered out in faux idealism when everybody got wrecked and then went home again afterwards and didn't actually start a revolution. Secondly, instead of really recreating Woodstock, I'd actually managed to recreate Altamont, because I'd hired a bunch of former war criminals as my security, and 500 of them had made off with all the money. So there was no way I could pay all the people I'd convinced to come and work on the understanding they get paid after the event. And thirdly, I'd had this wonderful idea that I was going to change the world and that would make me a great guy and everyone would love me. And instead, they all hated my guts because I couldn't pay them, and I'd told them I was going to spread love, understanding and positivity, and instead I'd made them all very, very angry. So I fled Serbia in a hurry with lots of unpaid debts to the tune of 300,000 euros, and I holed up in a farmhouse in France and had a nervous breakdown, taking lots of drugs. Whereupon I eventually pulled myself together and tried to write a story about this event, which has now been published in a book called A Rough Guide to the Dark Side, which I would gladly sell you a copy of should you like to come and talk to me afterwards for a special half price, £5. Thank you very much.
When I met him, which I think explains the way things ended up. It was Christmas, and my friend Kirsty, who's over there, and I had gone in search of kisses under the mistletoe. I was an elf, as I said, and she was a fairy. Sparkly tights, dress, wand. And she worked her godmother charm, and soon I was speaking to this boy. Or I should say, gentleman, because at about 6 foot something, with a really intense stare and an Italian charm, as well as the most impressive handlebar moustache I've ever seen on a living human, he was from another time. And we told him as much as we were giggling our way out of the club. And he said to me, "Well, I'll take you on an adventure. What's your favourite period in history?" The cowboys and Indians, I spluttered, not feeling my most imaginative at that point. So, the following Sunday, I met him on an empty Fleet Street, and he asked me if I wanted to be a cowboy or an Indian. I made my choice, and he produced a tinfoil sheriff's star, which I pinned to my coat. He'd asked me to bring along an apple. That was for two hobby horses made of cardboard, which he produced from his knapsack. Their manes were snipped to perfection. This man was very, very creative. In fact, every date he would present me with something that he'd rustled up at home. I haven't seen such skills with papier-mâché, glitter glue and cardboard since Anthea Turner left Blue Peter. But this kept on happening, and every date he would turn up in some element of costume, whether it would be just tucking his socks into his trousers or a funny belt, a hat, and this kept on going. And another interesting thing he would do would be to leave me presents on my doorstep. So I got a sock full of sweets, a bouquet of flowers with an artichoke at the centre. But he would travel an hour and a half to leave these at my doorstep. And I found it a bit unsettling that someone would cross the whole of London, stand outside the door and not ring the doorbell. And he would never engage in any kind of serious conversation. He'd just dismiss it as, "Oh, boring."
So time went on, and I thought, I'd probably let this one fizzle out. We're not really getting anywhere. So I hadn't seen him for a while. And on the 1st of March, I was running late for work. I flung open the door to find 8 red cut-out paw prints leading the way to the top step where there was a leak embellished with glitter glue with my name on it. And Happy St. David's Day, written in Welsh. I'm Welsh. That's why it was particularly, you know, sentimental. But as I said, I hadn't seen him for like 3 weeks at this point. And I thought, I'm going to have to take some direct action here. So I left it a day and then I sent him a text. Meet me on South Bank on Saturday. We're going to go for a coffee. And that in girl code means prepare yourself for some bad news. He didn't quite get this, and he came back, oh, I'll find something fun to do. So I thought, I'll make this really clear. No, no, keep it simple. We'll just go for a coffee. Meet me on South Bank. I arrived early, which demonstrates my resolve to break things off. And as I sat there on a bench watching the river flow by, boats, gulls picking sandwiches out of bins, I saw him arrive. He was dressed in red trousers, a khaki jacket which zipped up all the way to the hood, and the only part of his face I could see was his eyes behind the inbuilt goggles. And around his neck and down his back trailed a green felt tail. He was dressed as a dragon. I rang Kirsty. What do I do? Can I just, like, send him a text and I don't want to see him again, run away? As she collapsed in laughter in a world where people have conventional relationships and boys are normal, I could see him scanning the crowd for me. And although as a Saturday on South Bank, no one batted an eyelid, there was a man dressed as a mythological creature in their midst. I could see in his hand he was holding a paper daffodil. So I went up to him and we went for a walk. I tried to make it as gentle as possible. You know, I had a lot of fun and sorry, etc., etc. And he took it quite well. He turned to me and he said, do you know what? I had a feeling this might happen today. And my first thought was, oh, I'm glad my text was pretty clear then. And then I thought, and yet you still dressed as a dragon. So we continued walking for a bit. We crossed the river and we ended up back at the same point on Fleet Street where we'd met for our first date. And he said to me, you know, I wish you could have seen the real me in my jogging bottoms painting my bathroom on a Sunday. And he was pretty brave in many ways. I mean, he's... Dragon costume demonstrates his high-risk strategy to courting. But what he never got, until that moment at least, was that the biggest game, the most fun, silliest, most imaginative exploration of all, is that in between two people, as you're discovering that fragile magic that grows between you when you drop your guard and you open your entire being to another. And to dive into that fully, honestly, and without hiding behind glitter or silly costumes or a massive moustache, that is the biggest adventure. And it's rarer than finding your own dragon.
I want to do a line of you to wake me up when the day is through. You fill my mind, you crumble up. I mix you with the orange juice in my cup. Day falls away, the night is over. Spread the walls, I write your name.
ago, I went to India to do a photography project. I love photography and I love India, but one of the main motivations for going on this was that I was really quite in love with my fellow photographer. So we devised this photography project, which was sounds kind of mad, but to do a kind of set up a portrait studio in the Lal Bagh Gardens of Bangalore in order to document people who came into the gardens. And we had an amazing time. I bought the most beautiful shalwar kameez, I remember, on the way there, because I really wanted to be ready for this encounter. And we went round and we negotiated Lal Bagh Gardens that we could set up this photography studio. And we went round the markets and we bought the most beautiful textiles to hang on the back, as the back. And so it was all going very well. And it was all connected with a sort of South Asian art project that my fellow photographer knew and had worked with before. But as the days went on, I realized that there was this really very beautiful Indian dancer who he was rather interested in. And as the weeks went by, I retreated further into the bushes of Lal Bagh Gardens and didn't wear my shalwar kameez and was terribly upset. And being in this rather strange hotel in the middle of Bangalore, with this rather large room overlooking Bangalore, I'm crying quite a lot and ringing to my friends in Britain. So we ended badly. We had a row. And on the way back, I stopped off in Sri Lanka because the aeroplane stopped there. And I went to this really beautiful beach. You must go if it's not already been ruined, called Marissa, which is a beautiful curved beach. And I stayed with this family who really had just, you know, a very simple house on the beach. And they looked after me incredibly when I was drinking beer down the beach, crying. The father would come after me at midnight and take me home. And the wife would cook me these fantastic fish curries. And the little boy called Yassos, we would play drafts with and various games. And healing was coming after about a week. And so I came back to the UK ready to face the world again. And then a year later, I was watching the television and it was Boxing Day. And I looked and I saw the very place that I'd been, and it was a tsunami from Sri Lanka, and I saw the train that used to go past the back of the house and used to keep me awake at night being overturned and hundreds of people dying. And I was really sort of worried about this family who'd been giving me so much heart and really looked after me. And I thought, I must write to them. I must find out what's happened. So I wrote a letter to them. And there was no reply. And then there was no reply, and then there was no reply. And then about 3 months later, I got this letter. And they had saved their lives, but their house had been completely destroyed. And it was only because Yassos, the little boy, had been out playing, and he said, I've got this sound in my head, I've got this sound in my head. And because of that, they all managed to get up to the temple at the back, where there was some steps that went up to the temple at the back. So I collected money from friends and family and whatever, and we sent them a check to help them rebuild their home. And about 5 years later, I went to the Gore Literary Festival, which is a brilliant literary festival, and I thought, I need to go and see them, really. So I went after the festival and I walked down the beach and it had changed a bit. There was Bob Marley coming out of the, you know, speakers and things. And I thought, oh, this has really changed. And I walked past it. I thought maybe I won't recognize it. And then I did recognize the house. And I walked past it. And then I lost my nerve a bit and went away again. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Come on, you've got to go. And I walked up the steps and it was what, 6 years since we'd seen each other. And I just went into their yard. And the woman looked up, and she looked up at me and said my name, which was amazing, really, because it was just such a recognition. And we had the most amazing few days again. And Yassos, who was a little boy, he took me up to the temple and he showed me where they'd gone to be rescued. And he told me about the way that all their furniture had been swept away and sold by other people and things like that. And he pointed it all out to me. And then we went down and we had this supper. And his mum brought out an album of photographs. And I said, God, you know, you saved that. And she said, no, she said, Jungleside, that's the other place. The photographer had still had the negatives of all their lives that they had lost. So he was able to reproduce the photograph. So they had the family album, and that was practically all that was left. And so we looked out, we had another fish supper, and we looked out, and there was really a lot of hearts being healed that night.
You paint my face. We're reclaiming the city space. You hold my hand, I shut your eyes. Airplanes leave the trail across the skies. We watch the shape the pattern made. You're the only drug I need to take for the night. We chop each other. The biggest mirror for the night. We chop each other up on the biggest mirror. You smile at me, you look away.
I've heard quite a few stories about families and things like that, from the sublime to the ridiculous to the scary to the heartwarming. This is a story about my brother. And what happens when you get older, you know, you spend a lot of time when you're children fighting. I was telling my kids off yesterday for blaming each other for something that was clearly both their faults and not what they claim each other's faults. And, if you've got a younger brother, especially if there's a good few years between you, you don't really get to know what they're like because they annoy you, right? you grow up and, you go to university, you get a job, you do whatever you do. And if you're lucky, right, you might get to know them as an adult. Right? It's not always the way because, you know, family gatherings when you get older tend to be, Christmas, birthdays, marriages, death, that sort of stuff. And those aren't great occasions for having a laugh or making friends. But I was lucky enough to be friends with my younger brother. And a couple of years ago, he came to live in London. Yeah, I got him a job at my company where I was working. And before he moved his family down, he came to live with me up the road for 3 months. And we hadn't spent any time together for, I don't know, 20 years, right? But, you know, whenever we got together, because we were friends, we used to have a really good time and let our hair down. And, this is a story about, I suppose, what happens if you're lucky enough to spend some time with, you know, a brother or sister when you're grown up. And you can do what you want, right? And it's weird because, you know, when you've got families, quite often you don't get to do what you want, right? You know, there's always someone bugging you to do something that you don't want to do. You know, you might want to read the paper, you're getting your ankles pulled, you're swimming, whatever it happens to be. You know, and the idea of being able to go to the pub or smoke a joint or do whatever you want whenever you want to do it is foreign. And, you know, he just had his first kid and had gone through all the sleeplessness, all the horror of not knowing when you were ever going to go to bed or when you were ever going to be able to do anything you wanted to do for yourself ever again. So this 3 months was like a golden time. And it was Thursday night, and we'd gone to the pub after work. And we rock up back at my house, you know, a few sheets to the wind, put some music on, you know, have something else to drink, have something to eat. It's midnight, right? It's a Thursday night. It's a school night. Anyway, we're having a good time. And YouTube, I don't know, YouTube's probably the best invention for staying up late and getting drunk, right? Because all the things you remember from when you're younger are on YouTube, right? It's brilliant. And so there we are. You know, it's 1 o'clock. Oh, have you seen this? Check this out. Boom, boom, boom. Really loud. Fantastic, fantastic. Anyway, it's 2 o'clock, right? We've still got some beer. We're thinking about whiskey. And I remember, and this is a drug that won't come up very often in these, I remember that I've got some amyl nitrate in the in the bathroom cabinet. And I'm like, you're going to stay here. You've got to hear this tune and have a hit of this. And I race upstairs. I get a little bottle of amyl nitrate and stick it under his nose and press play. And we're just, whoa! Absolutely fantastic. And we basically spend the rest of the night going, listen to this. Anyway, I eventually retire injured on Friday morning, right, at about 4:30. And Ewan's going, oh, I'm just going to stay up. I'll have another cigarette in the garden. I'll see you later. Anyway, I get up. My alarm goes off. I get up at about 8:30. And I go downstairs. All the windows are open. All the windows are open. And it's just, it's like 50 people have had a party. It's just the two of us. I walk out into the garden, and there's a guitar on the deck in the garden. There's loads of beer bottles. And the grass, there's a massive burnt patch on the grass. I have to stand there trying with the worst head you can possibly imagine to piece together what could possibly have happened after I went to bed. Right? And so I can't. I'm kind of wandering around. Okay, everything's open. Have we been burgled? What happened? Did people break in and have a party? Who knows? Anyway, Ewan kind of pushes the living room door open. And he's like, oh, fuck. Look at my hand. And basically, his hand is burnt all the way up to where his shirt sleeve was rolled down. I said, what the fuck happened to you? And he goes, well, you know, you went to bed. And I went, yeah. And he goes, well, sitting in the garden, and I'd lit a fag, right? And I'm smoking a fag. I think, you know, before I go to bed, I'll have another hit of that amyl nitrate. Right? So he lifts the amyl nitrate up and sets himself on fire because he hasn't taken the cigarette out of his mouth. Right? So, of course, his face goes up. His arm goes up because instead of throwing it away, he tips it back and it goes all over his arm. And then he drops it on the floor. So not only is his face on fire, his arm's on fire, and the ground's on fire. And he goes, you'll never guess what hassle I had putting it out. And it's just like, I can only imagine what he was like. He goes, dancing. Anyway. The next problem was what he was going to tell his missus, because he had to Skype every night at 7 o'clock or he was in major trouble. And this is the bit about, you know, escaping the gravitational pull of families and reconnecting with your youth and everything like that when you're in your late 30s. Anyway, we never told her what happened. I said, look, just say you got wasted and spilt omelette juice on you or something, or they made a dangerous sandwich at 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever it happened to be. Anyway, it still stands out as one of my great memories of a time together with him. And, you know, it was only a couple of months later after his wife had moved down with their son that she phoned me up the morning after the last time I'd seen him, and he died. And he'd just gone to sleep after being at our house the night before and never woke up. And he was 39. And, you know, if you get a chance next time you see your brother or your sister, you know, do something that you're going to remember. Because you never know when you're not going to see them again. Anyway, I told that story at his funeral, and his wife found out what happened to his arm.
So thanks to all of our storytellers. Dave, that's me, Grenier, Peter, Sahand, Patricia, Daniel, Miranda, Ethne and Rob. It's the stories that make Spark London Nights so amazing to be a part of. And that is only made possible by people coming along to our nights and choosing to share their lives with our audiences. Behind me, you can hear Wet Hands, which is a song written and performed by Dan Weltman. Dan is the man who made our theme tune, and we love it, and we're really grateful to him for making it for us. This song is from his album Inside the Walls that he recorded under the name Hollow Body, and you can find that on Bandcamp. Go over there, buy it, buy this song. If you're interested in him as a composer, he's on Facebook as Dan W. Composer and at www.danielweltman.com. That's WELTMAN.com. Spark London can be found at www.sparklondon.com. Over there, it'll tell you when all of our nights are, so check out our website for more details about that. I don't just host Spark London, I also host and run a night called Stand Up Tragedy, which frequently features Spark London storytellers who I've heard, who I book for that night. Stand Up Tragedy is where we aim to make you cry until you laugh and laugh until you cry. Our next night is going to be on the 12th of December at the Dog Star in Brixton. That is going to be a charity fundraiser for the amazing organisation Arts Emergency. It's going to be themed around Christmas too. We're going to be bringing you a tragic Christmas. So come along and share some tragedy with us. www.standuptragedy.co.uk. And it's a podcast too. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher and SoundCloud. So check us out there. I also make a podcast called Getting Better Acquainted, where I have conversations with the people I know, from someone I might have once met at a party to my closest friends and family. They're really fascinating conversations with people about their lives, and they're as varied as people are. And I really would love you to come and get better acquainted with those people with me. It's on iTunes, it's on SoundCloud, it's on the Stitcher Smart Radio app. Find out more about it at www.gettingbetteracquainted.co.uk. This has been a Getting Better Acquainted production for Spark London. My name's Dave Pickering. Thank you very much.
I filled my pockets up with rain. Up with rain. I filled my pockets up with rain, up with rain. I filled my pockets up with rain, up with rain, up with rain.
Hold up. What was that?
Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.